Good afternoon, and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm Lena Berman, and I'll be here with you live on Tuesdays at noon, talking to you about healthcare and fitness trends and taking your phone calls. Today's show is called Creating a Non-Toxic Home and Office. This is a follow-up show on our show on environmental illness. I have two guests with me today. It's David Kibbe from the Natural Building Network and David Bierman, who is an acupuncturist. Both are healthy home consultants. And I'll be interviewing them. And after the first half hour at 12:30, as usual, I'll open up the phone lines during a brief musical break. And you'll be invited to participate in the show with your questions, which I'll take, as usual, right on the air. Now, before I introduce my guests, I really want to add something to last week's show that I did on exercise prudence, the dangers of overtraining and underresting. People are sometimes confused on the special timing of eating as it relates to exercise. As children, I think we were all warned about the hazards of swimming too soon after a meal. Were those warnings warranted? Just like everything else, people are very individual. What's good to remember is that right after you eat, the body wants to send blood to the stomach to aid digestion. So if you're exercising, you're also asking for the blood to be sent to your muscles. So it's a little confusing for your body. For most people, eating right before exercise causes a little bit of stomach distress. And for some, it's never a problem. So remember that you do need to fuel your system if you want to perform. So it's important to eat sometime before working out. Don't expect to work out if you haven't eaten yet for the day. But how much and how long before is going to be very individual for you. A large meal right before may not be efficient for everyone, but for those who work out very early in the morning, some kind of, I don't know, maybe a smoothie or a protein drink may be best because it's easily assimilated. In addition, taking some moderate exercise right after a large meal, like a gentle walk, can aid digestion, and for people with significant weight problems, it's ideal. Since obesity blunts the thermic effect of food, exercising right after a meal can help to normalize your metabolism if you are obese. Some other special health considerations that affect the timing of a meal are, for instance, diabetes. With diabetes, patients should exercise 1 to 2 hours after a meal when the blood sugar is high. See, what happens with exercise with diabetes is it can lower the blood sugar, people who have diabetes, for up to 8 hours. So it's very important for people who have diabetes to exercise. Heart disease patients should exercise aerobically, you know, that's like endurance exercise, before eating to maximize blood flow to their hearts. They should combine vigorous exercise 5 days a week for 30 to 40 minutes, I don't know if I agree about 5 days, with a high-fiber, low-fat diet. I'm reading this from a report in Physician Sports Medicine. Heart disease patients can also benefit from a brisk walk after a meal, again, since blood tends to clot after eating. In addition, becoming a couch potato after eating sets patients up for the formation of blood clots that can lodge in an artery, so you need to keep moving if you have heart disease and diabetes. In addition, compulsive dieters who have taken the low-fat vegetarian way to eating to an extreme need special attention because Dr. Alvin Lucy, who I've interviewed before, has seen a lot of young female vegetarians who become calcium and iron deficient and wind up with stress fractures, tendonitis, and early osteoporosis. So a balanced diet is important, and you must eat. So we get so focused on carbohydrates, we forget about the other things that are going on in the body when you're exercising. I think you've already heard me go on a toot about that. Okay, let me not take any more time away from this very important show. Let me start by introducing my two guests. Again, we're talking about creating a non-toxic home and office. In addition, if anyone has additional questions about exercise and nutrition, I'll be giving my number out at the end of the show. All right, David Kibbe is a leader in the Natural Building Network and architects, designers, planners for social responsibility. He's a consultant for Safe Environments Home and Office Testing Laboratories, a member of Berkeley Unified School District's Materials Indoor Air Quality Standard Committee, and founder of his own consultation and inspection service. David teaches a workshop on healthful building materials for the Building Education Center and speaks at a variety of conferences, colleges, and universities. Currently, he's collaborating on a 13-part television series about sustainable architecture entitled Earth Sweet Home. So welcome so much to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. R. David Bierman is the owner of Safe Environments Home and Office Testing Services. He's also a licensed acupuncturist with a practice here in Berkeley, and his specialty is mold problems in buildings, their health effects, and treatment and cleanup. So again, welcome. I have two Davids here. I'm going to have to go by eye contact so that you know who I'm talking to. So welcome to you, David Bierman. All right, let's start off with what I consider an important issue. Many of the people who have contacted me since I did the show on environmental illness are ill enough so that they are living on disability or their finances are being drained by expensive health care costs. For a large percentage of people, their illness came on rather suddenly after some kind of toxic insult. So I want to be sure that we address the issues of cleaning up an environment first by talking about the least costly and easiest things that all people, ill or healthy, can do to protect themselves from everyday toxic exposure. Who wants to go first?
I'd be happy to start.
Okay,
this
David.
Is David Kibbe. Kibbe. There are a number of things in our environment which affect people with chemical sensitivities particularly. It is beginning to be something in my awareness that it's not just those who are particularly sensitized to chemicals, but that in fact it is in some way affecting the health of all of us.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to insinuate.
Exactly. But the idea of doing some things immediately that don't cost a lot of money, that are not really sophisticated or technologically complex, really some of them are very simple.
Like?
One of them is don't wear perfume.
Thank you.
I can only tell you that I was in a meeting of about 30 people the other day, which is ordinarily a fragrance-free meeting, and someone not knowing that fact walked in late. And I know I began to taste a metallic taste
right
on my tongue. I had a pounding heart. My head began to ache. My hands were shaking, and I could no longer concentrate. And I don't have environmental
yes
illness.
Yes, I'd like to comment on that. I am terribly sensitive to fragrances, and I had a situation where I was seeing somebody who wore cologne, and I insisted that he just simply stop wearing it. Now, he works in toxic cleanup for the government. He stopped wearing the cologne, and 2 weeks later, his skin still smelled. So we talked about it, and he said, you know, I must be outgassing this right out of the pores of my skin. That means it's gone right into the bloodstream. So he took it in, and he tested it. This is one of the most popular colognes for men. It was filled with the most frightening carcinogenic materials you can imagine, toluene, benzene. I mean, really terrifying. So it doesn't, you know, if you don't have multiple chemical sensitivities, you continue to wear cologne, you are absorbing it into your bloodstream.
Exactly.
Okay.
But in terms of the interior environment, it seems to me that there are a few very basic things, like having windows that open,
mm-hmm,
plenty of fresh air circulation, using cleaning products that are more natural and less synthetic.
Without fragrance.
Without fragrance. And there are a great number of them, and there are a great number of publications, which we can talk about later if you like,
mm-hmm,
that identify what some of these things are. I've identified 11 main hazards for common causes of sick buildings or building-related illnesses, and I'd be happy to talk about them in more detail.
Okay.
A few things to add here. Due to the level of toxic assault that we're all subjected to living in an urban environment, and also people who live in a non-urban environment as well have a lot of exposure, I would recommend, just from the health point of view, is to load up on antioxidants.
Uh-huh, supplements.
Primarily antioxidants,
mm-hmm,
which are specifically designed to attack free radicals, which are part of what is involved in the cellular assault that we get into.
Why don't you remind people of the most important ones?
A, E, C, beta-carotene,
mm-hmm,
glutathione, or some of the antioxidants. Selenium is another antioxidant.
The selenium, we have to be a little careful with the level,
right,
huh?
Right.
Okay.
Now, the other factor that I want to add is one cheap fix that can be done in a home, which I think is really important, is to make sure that for people who live in homes that have crawl spaces or basements, to make sure that the barrier between the crawl space or basement and the interior building envelope is sealed. That means someone needs to get down underneath the crawl space and look for any types of light coming in from the building and to make sure that's all sealed with foam, because it's really clear that that's a big problem.
Actually, what I did with my own home, which was phenomenally helpful because I have a crawl space is I started out by putting a vapor barrier of plastic down in the crawl space, and then I insulated the floor with Reflectix, which is the foil wrapped plastic, which was I found easier to tolerate than regular foam.
Yeah.
So that's real important, is to block. In other words, what he's saying is you want to block the mold spores from coming up through your floor, which is very important. In addition, you know, I suggested this to some of my neighbors across the street because they were having so much mold in their house, even though they weren't particularly sensitive to it, and it made a huge difference just to put the vapor barrier down.
Yeah, the vapor barrier, and then also making sure that any cracks or holes that go in, the pipes go through, the wiring goes through, all those little holes, if you add it all up, start to become like a square foot of actual hole into the crawl space.
There's another very major attribute to a healthy home, and that is a home that uses alternative pesticide control.
Thank you.
That's one of the major items. Most of the pesticide products are based on petrochemicals, which in many cases can be highly allergenic to everyone, as well as particularly harmful to those people who have developed chemical sensitivities.
Well, it's a good point to bring this up now, since the ants have really, they're really populating right now, and they're really coming in. So I have my own favorite things. Do you guys have favorite ant control things?
There are lots of things for controlling ants, as well as for controlling cockroaches, as well as for controlling subterranean termites and the other common pests. One of the most important ones is simply to create a barrier. Don't let the critters in. So when you find where the trail is that the ants are coming in, a little bit of caulking at that entry point will often dissuade them from coming in. Sealing entry holes in the outside of the building, pipe penetrations, that sort of thing. For termites, very often a very simple sand barrier can be placed around the foundation of the building. And the termites, the subterranean termites, cannot build a tunnel that will hold together through that sand, so they can't gain entry to the building. And there are techniques like that that are really very simple and very inexpensive. The
boric acid.
Okay, go ahead and go over
the boric acid one now.
Well, basically, the boric acid is taken in by the cockroaches, and I believe the ants as well, into the nests by the trails, and then the boric acid dehydrates them and kills them in the nests.
So just powdered boric acid in the places that they're coming in.
Yeah.
I've tried various ones of these things that you've suggested, and I've never succeeded in sealing the entry. What I've been using is as clean as possible soap, you know, in water to spray directly on them when I find them, and following that with peppermint oil and water, because over a period, it doesn't work immediately. It's not like using Raid. But eventually what happens is that they dislike the mint, and they after a day or so of persistence, they will stop coming through in that area. I also had somebody suggest cucumber slices, and I resorted to those yesterday. I feel ridiculous. My house looks like a salad, but it did seem to deter them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of others. Well,
there are cayenne pepper is another one, and there are a number of
disruptors. It has to be something that you can tolerate. I mean, the mint spray gets a little heavy after a while.
Another factor to be concerned about when we brought up the pesticide issue is a lot of these older homes have been treated with chlordane, which is a chlorinated hydrocarbon. And what we found, and others have found, that extremely low levels of chlordane can be fairly toxic.
Mm.
So, and it does get into a vaporous state. So, and I found actually in my own analysis of certain homes that the levels were very, very high in crawl spaces. So the idea of blocking the crawl space is still, you know, applicable to that problem as well.
It still makes sense. We're going to go over how to choose a home. One of the other things I'm wondering about is there's a new pest control thing that's freezing the pests. Have you heard? Does it work?
It works.
Oh,
it
wonderful.
Works more effectively, in fact, from what I understand, than the pesticide methods of killing, particularly above ground termites, the beetle-type termites that get into houses, the kind of thing that usually a house is tented and then sprayed with a very toxic pesticide. What is done in this case is the colonies are located through determining where the warmth of their bodies are in the house, which can be done electronically. It's also done with dogs that sniff the colonies. And then it's frozen with liquid nitrogen in a selective area where the termites actually exist. And apparently the repopulation by new colonies is much less frequent than it is with those that are pesticided.
That's very interesting. All right, let's also talk a little bit about water and air filters, because there's sort of the water and air filters you can buy at Costco, and then there are water and air filters. So do you have some recommendations for people on those?
Well, on that water issue, you have two ways to go. One is carbon block filtration, and the other one is reverse osmosis. Each one has its drawbacks. If you're looking to get rid of heavy metals, then reverse osmosis is the way to go. But if you're looking to filter out common chemicals, then carbon block is. One that is around for a lot of people is the multi-pure carbon block, solid carbon block. It should be a solid carbon block. That's very important. And the other thing is that it should have a fairly long life. Usually the multi-pure is 6 months to a year. I think that I recommend that, tend to recommend that myself.
Okay. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, yes. In this area where water is a real problem, then the reverse osmosis filtration system does have the drawback of having quite a lot of water waste, which just goes down the drain. So, and the other thing is that with reverse osmosis, it takes a lot of the nutritive minerals out of the water. So if you're using this as drinking water, then it's my opinion that probably, particularly in this climate, the carbon block filter is more effective.
Air filters.
Well, the two ways to go with air filters is, first of all, there are a lot of filters on the market that are not really that effective.
Right, that's my impression.
Yeah, they just don't carry the volume, they don't move enough air, they don't have enough carbon in them. And depending on what the need is, if it's a mold problem, then you're looking for filtration with the HEPA filtration. But if it's a gas or a chemical problem, then you're looking for carbon.
So carbon, and there's also this Purifil that Faust uses.
Yeah, Purifil is a potassium permanganate compound.
Okay.
Some people are sensitive to it and are not. But the one that I like the most right now for a modular filter, in other words, to put it in a bedroom or something, is the Austin Air. Because it's got a very large amount of carbon, and it's got a good filter, and it's in a solid metal. And for the money, I think it's what I like the best. Whole house filters are another story. There's a lot of different possibilities. I don't like, which is what a lot of people use, is the Honeywell, which is the static electric charged one. And the simple fix for a lot of houses is to upgrade the filter that you already have, or to put in a permastatic filter.
You want to add something?
Yeah, I would add a little bit to that. The just on the subject of the electrostatic precipitator type of filter, I know a lot of people have been told that it's a very, very efficient system of getting contaminants out of the air. And one of the problems is that though the type of electronic filter, the Honeywell type that David mentioned, which plugs into the electric supply of the house in order to create a static electricity charge to gather the particles on a screen, every so often arcs and arcs electricity and spits that gathered contaminant back into the airstream. So after it's been in use for a very short period of time, matter of hours actually, it begins to lose its efficiency. And so after a week or two, there's almost no efficiency left. The static precipitators that you simply wash with a hose that operate from the motion of the air of the furnace system are actually much more effective. But true whole house filtration is a kind of system that if you have a forced air furnace, particularly if you can do ventilation, that is just blow the fan without heat, and even if in fact you have an air conditioner associated with the air handling system, then you should be able then, with whole house filtration attached to that system, with a three-bank set of filters, filter all of the air, whether it's heated air or cooled air or just ventilating air.
Now, see, what I understood about this, because I bought an old house and had no heat in it, and it's cold enough where I live so that I had to think about some way to do central heating. I couldn't just do it with electric heaters, and also with electric heaters, this is, we should go on to heat, I think. We had the problem of fried, what they call fried dust, which is, again, hydrocarbons, you know, in your face. But you know, my impression when I looked into forced air is it's, you know, it's forced dirt. You're blowing dirt around, and the filters, you have to have, like, this monster filter, and then you know?
Well, there's actually been a little bit more advanced. There are filter mechanisms now that are pretty small and compact that work fairly well. The important element to do with when you're dealing with a whole house and a forced air gas system is, you can have all the filtration you want, but if your duct system is leaky, mm-hmm. and most people's duct systems are leaky, like 95% of everybody's duct systems are leaky, you're going to be sucking whatever's into the crawl space, into the duct.
Oh,
so,
boy.
So it's really extremely important is to seal. All the ducts have to be, all the junctions and all the ducts have to be sealed with a water-soluble mastic, which will actually set up so that there's no leakage, because there's a massive amount of leakage in the duct system.
What I did after reviewing everything that was out there, including these bizarre electric radiant heat things that were, and thinking about electromagnetic fields and everything else, is I went with forced water in two baseboards, and I would do it again in a minute. It's the most amazing heating system I've ever had, and it's extraordinarily cheap to run.
What that brings to mind is if we were to back up a step and talk about heating from the very beginning, we would realize that the very best kind of heat mm-hmm. for our human bodies mm-hmm. In our homes is a natural radiant heat. Mm-hmm. And the absolute best kind of radiant heat is a natural kind of radiant heat that comes from something called a kachelofen, which is a very ancient, over 1,000-year-old technique of heating homes with wood heat that was used in Northern Europe and in Scandinavia. Kachelofen means tile oven or tile stove. It's a very carefully hand-built, very large stove that burns a tiny fire, very, very hot, early in the morning. It keeps the stones of the ceramic stones or tiles of the oven hot, radiating a gentle heat for the entire day's length. Sometimes in a large home, it's necessary to refire it for a half an hour or so again in the evening, and it stays warm all night. And we're talking about northern, very cold, sub-freezing climates.
What occurs to me on that, aside from the fact that I haven't seen those available and I really shopped hard for heating, is that people with autoimmune disease, not just chemical sensitivities are usually, I mean, not everybody believes this. I tend to believe that it is associated with an autoimmune disease. Most people with that are also very sensitive to hot and cold changes, and one of the advantages to the radiant water heat is that you have a thermostat, and it just stays.
Well, we'd have to still continue to back up just a moment in history in order to understand that. These kachelofens create a kind of gentle heat which is even more gentle and more gradual uh-huh. than the baseboard heat, and the fire is zero emissions.
Okay.
It's absolutely clean. And it is not so hot, but what, in fact, it's usually a kind of bench or other furniture feature in the center of the house
okay.
where you actually can sit on it. It's mm-hmm. children are attracted to it to do their homework or sit and have a sandwich.
Who's selling these?
There is a company in Napa called European Masonry Heaters that is selling kachelofens and the kind of spin-off technology, which is masonry heater stoves, which are manufactured stoves.
And they're pretty cost-effective to put in.
They are very costly to put in,
uh-huh.
but in the end, they cost virtually nothing to run.
Okay.
So it takes a long time for the payback, but the payback is complete.
And heating the house is absolutely crucial to keeping the mold population down, because I went from having a slightly moldy house to having no problem at all after I put in a good heating system.
Well, the main factors with mold is lack of ventilation, excess moisture, and not having any heat. The heat factor is, you know, if you keep a house nice and warm and dry being the important element of it, and obviously as you lower your temperature, you increase your moisture potential, you'll lower your mold.
Makes a big difference. Building materials. I renovated my house. I learned more about non-toxic or so-called non-toxic or less toxic building materials than I ever wanted to know. Do you have some sort of quick suggestions for people on where they can go to shop for stuff that's at least going to be safer? And how much safer is that stuff?
Well, we're talking about a subject much larger than we have the capacity
right.
to speak
in
about
this time,
here.
Yeah.
But essentially, the old traditional natural building materials mm-hmm. are less toxic. Essentially, in a nutshell, the new synthetic petrochemically manufactured products, off-gas volatile organic compounds and formaldehydes and any number of other chemically unstable gases, which make it very toxic, and which is why we hear more and more now about sick building syndrome, building-related illness, and environmental illness. So generally, the older, more traditional materials like wood, for instance, or stone, or clay are better choices.
In terms of paints and sealers, there are some companies that are making less complex products, still using plastics, but keeping them more simple. And for some people, what I've found is that some people can tolerate plastic better than they can tolerate linseed oil, for instance.
Well, the thing that we discover, particularly in the realm of paints and finishes, mm-hmm. is that every building is different, every mm-hmm. application is different, every client is different, every mm-hmm. building resident is different. Mm-hmm. But there are three basic directions to go, and one is the natural, non-toxic, plant chemistry kinds of materials that are imported from Germany for paints and varnishes.
Mm-hmm. See, I can't go near that stuff myself.
Which yeah. bother those with yeah. chemical sensitivities yeah. who are sensitive to the citrus aroma from the natural oils.
Or the linseed oil.
Right. There yeah. is another chemically manufactured but specifically designed system for those who have chemical sensitivities, which uses, you know, acrylic kinds of compounds, but they're low odor, fast curing. They tend to hermetically seal in the odors of whatever may be beneath and so on. That is another realm in which it's possible to go. There are some people who can tolerate those kinds of paints very quickly. Professional painters often complain that they don't handle the same way as the standard materials.
Don't.
On the other hand, there are now some mainstream companies who are manufacturing zero VOC, zero petroleum solvent, very low odor, very fast curing, highly satisfactory kinds of materials. There are at least three mainstream companies that are doing that.
It has to be quick.
Just in relationship to the issue of VOCs in houses.
Yes.
That's why the problem with new houses is just loaded with chemicals.
Yes. So maybe if you can quickly give us some suggestions. Oh, boy, that's going to be hard. You know what we should do is, why don't both of you give out your phone numbers now? Then people scurry and get a pencil. Right before we go to break, give out both of your phone numbers where you can be reached. And then when we come back from break, very quickly, I'd like some suggestions on how to choose a home or an office.
I can be reached at 5499.
This is David Bierman.
Safe Environments at 549-9693 in Berkeley.
And repeat that number.
549-9693.
And David Kibbe.
And I'm at 510-841-1039.
Okay, so again, the number.
That's 841-1039.
Okay, so what we've discovered is that there's an individual nature to this, just like everything else. What we're going to do is take our quick musical break. You can start calling in now at 510-848-4425, 510-848-4425. This is a special show on Your Own Health and Fitness on KPFA on Non-Toxic Home and Office with David Kibbe and David Bierman. We're going to take a brief musical break. We'll be right back with your phone calls and a few other pieces of information. This is Lena Berman. We'll be right back.
Your time will come. So, child, don't mess with that cotton sack. It's gonna scratch your knees and bend your back. And if you live, your time will come. Oh, well, if you live, your day will come. I say, if you live, your day will come. Child, don't play with those pots and pans. They're gonna soon enough ruin your pretty hands. And if you live, your time will come.
Welcome back. This is Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness Talk Show on KPFA. We're doing a special show today on creating a non-toxic home and office. I'm with David Bierman and with David Kibbe. And we're going to take your phone calls at 510-848-4425. 510-848-4425. If you get a busy signal, we're getting a little jammed up. Just keep trying because lines will open up. And remember to turn down your radio when we take your call so we don't get feedback. Very quickly, if we can, just some tips for people in choosing a house or an office.
Okay. the two aspects of dealing with choosing a house, you have to divide it between a new house and an old house. In an old house, you're going to be concerned with lead paint, asbestos, and mold problems, usually also possible pesticide issues. In a new house, you're going to be more concerned about volatile organic compounds, what they use in the house. I would never recommend, unless you know exactly what was used, to buy a brand new house.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Buying a house that's 10 years old is actually kind of in between. It's probably one of the best ways to go. If you're going to buy an old house, you're going to have very look seriously at the crawl space and review those issues of lead, asbestos, and fungi problems, mold problems.
Those are fixable.
Most of the stuff is fixable, yeah. Unless there's been some real specific problem. Now, if you are chemically sensitive and you've got sensitivity issues, then you're going to have
highly off-gassing, unstable materials. But that, combined with new concerns for energy, has created tight buildings,
yes,
that don't ventilate very well. So you have a higher degree of toxic materials in a much lower level of ventilated space. So it makes it a problem, which is one of the reasons I'm involved in the Natural Building Network, because we're looking at some of the kinds of materials that you can build houses with that reduce those source levels of contaminants. So we're building houses out of straw bale, building them out of compressed clay with rammed earth.
Yeah, I've heard about this. Yeah. All right, I think we better start taking these calls. These lines are just jumping. Let's take the first call. This is Lena Berman. You're on KPFA. Do you have a question?
Yeah, this is Bill. I'm calling from Palo Alto. I had a question about the comment on mineral removal with the reverse osmosis systems. I've been looking at this for a long time, and I have had a hard time finding strong evidence for nutritional effect from removing minerals from water. Even in the worst case at about 500 milligrams per liter in the water, that's only a gram per day for a typical consumer at 2 liters per day. And if you're on Hetch Hetchy water around here, you're probably only around 100 milligrams.
So basically, rather than asking a question, what you're saying is that for you, with the research that you've done, you feel that removing the minerals may not be devastating, and then if it's a good way to do it, then that's
fine. Well, I'd certainly like to know how or know where there's some evidence for a nutritional effect from minerals in water. There's such a wide variation in
I'm getting shrugs on either side. I think that's the subject of another show. I think what they were just saying is that that is one of the sacrifices you make when you go in that direction. So, you may have a point there. Anyway, I want to thank you for your call.
Thanks.
Let's take another caller. This is Lena Berman. You're on KPFA. Do you have a question for us?
Yeah. I live in an apartment building and have central heating, which is gas. What can I do, since I'm particularly sensitive to everything in the world, about not using that heat?
Okay, we're going to let David Kibbe answer your call off the air.
Okay. The idea of being sensitive to the gas is something that is not unique to any one person. But the gas, as we know, is toxic. The combustion byproducts that come from burning gas are toxic, and there are a great number of them, the primary one being carbon monoxide. In the best of all possible worlds, we would combine the efficiency of gas heat with isolating that gas heat so that we don't breathe the combustion byproducts and don't get that polluted contaminant into the airstream. So the best thing would be to move the furnace to an outside location.
She lives in an apartment, though, so it would be nice to address her particular concerns.
Okay, well, in that case, I would say that the most important thing is to make sure that the filters are clean.
Well, again, if she lives in an apartment, what is she supposed to do there?
Well, going to have to talk to the manager, I'm afraid.
Do we have another solution?
Somehow
for
you've
her?
Got to get to the source.
Obviously, in making sure that the filters are clean from talking to the manager, but possibly for her to have a modular air filter.
That's what
in
I
her
was
house,
thinking, is
and
to get an air filter.
Especially in her bedroom would be the way to go, I think, in
yeah,
her case.
Yeah. Oh, and I guess in the worst case scenario is, depending on where you live, incidentally, I'm sorry that you got cut off so fast. But if you live in an area that's not really, really freezing cold, you might be able to just have somebody shut off your gas heat and use an electric
heater. Yeah, putting inner therms, which are the portable water heater type of units, is a good way to go as well.
Or DeLonghi's or something.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to another caller. You're on KPFA. Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, you were mentioning about the non-toxic paints, you know, like from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a case reading it in the paper a year or two or more ago. Some woman in Berkeley, or she was a member of the city council, might have been Carla Woodworth. She repainted her home with that non-toxic stuff from Germany, and then her whole house ended up smelling like sour milk, and she couldn't live there. She had to get out and repaint it, and I think she was going to sue the manufacturer of the paint. Do you know anything about that?
We're going to let David Kibbe respond to you.
Yes, I do recall that case, and I too have forgotten the name of the council person who was involved there, but I remember wishing at the time that she had called me before she went to the extravagant degree that she did of removing the wallboard from the walls and completely replacing it, and then painting with a standard over-the-counter mainstream paint, which made her so sick that she had to move out. And meanwhile, her clothing had been so filled with the odors that she pretty much had to throw all her clothing away as well.
Oh, God.
So I remember thinking at the time that, number one, the first thing that would have helped would be if she had looked at the labels on the cans, because this was a milk product casein paint that she was using. Mm-hmm. And as we know with milk products, when we buy them from the grocery store, they have an expiration date.
Mm-hmm.
And if when she opened it and it smelled bad, she had closed it up and gotten rid of it and gotten a new batch, she would have been better off. It should be known, however, that casein paints are not new. Casein paints were used by the Egyptians, and those paintings still exist in the tombs from 4,000 or 5,000 years
ago. A milk-sensitive person, though, is also going to have some problems with this.
A highly milk-sensitive person is likely to, but meanwhile, it should be known that there are powdered casein paints where you mix the water with the paint as you use it, and then this shelf life issue becomes a moot point.
It's important to note that I've been involved in a couple of cases where of bad paint using non-toxic paints, and the problem is that they don't use as much mildewcide or bactericides in the paints. Mm-hmm. So the paints, if they go past their shelf life or there's a bad batch, can be bad paint, and then the odor stays in the paint. Now, it's important to smell the paint and see if it smells strange or something like that. Mm. Then, you know, there could be an issue there. But generally, the paints will be good.
So another point is that if you buy extra and you have some sitting in your garage, you may want to check the paint out before you do any retouch. All right, let's get another caller on the line. You're on KPFA with Lena Berman. Do you have a question for us today?
Yes. On insecticides, for years I've been using Chinese chalk, and I never knew what was in it. It's incredibly effective for ants and cockroaches. I lived in an apartment which, when I moved in, was infested with cockroaches and with ants, and I haven't seen them since I used it. It's sold anywhere in Chinatown. It's called Miraculous Insecticide, and I would love to know what's in it, because it says it's not toxic, and it seems not to be.
Do I have someone who knows?
I don't know exactly what that product is, but one of the common materials that's used for this purpose is diatomaceous earth.
Uh-huh,
I wouldn't be surprised if a pure form of diatomaceous earth might not be what's being talked about. This is a material that, again, the animals ingest, and it dehydrates them, and they take it back to their colonies, and they die. Its only danger to humans is that it's an extremely fine dust, and so you need to, you know,
put a mask on,
it's like a dust hazard.
Hmm. Okay.
I've seen that Chinese talk as well. I don't know what's in it.
Miraculous insecticide. It's probably not expensive. Let's move on to another caller. You're on KPFA. Do you have a question?
Yeah. I was hearing the other lady talk about the heat problem, which is the same as my problem. And getting an electric heater is very expensive. So what are the alternatives? You mentioned to her about an air filter. That's one alternative, but I still need to heat the house, the apartment.
Okay, well, let's try to answer your question off the air here.
Okay.
Do you have something, David Berman?
Well,
David Kibbe.
Again, I guess, you know, if we were to think in terms of an apartment, it's very hard to have any kind of control over the source of the central heat.
Exactly.
And so it really becomes a kind of a problem of dealing with management. If electric heat is too expensive given these circumstances, then the only thing I could suggest would be to seal off some of the rooms of the apartment during the cold season.
Yeah, and just heat one room.
And just use the electric heat in one room. Mm-hmm. There are some alternatives which, if you have control of the space and you're able to do, there's some very interesting new alternatives to wood-burning heat. Wood-burning, of course, is not a clean way of heating, and there are no burn days. But now there is a system of using pellet stoves.
Yeah, see, I looked into the pellet stuff, and I got six standing near it, so well, I think you have to be real careful with that.
Well, there's one last one, which is what I was going to mention. I just found from a store in Brattleboro, Vermont, that is using a system very much like the pellet stove, fairly low cost. I guess it's about $1,000 for the installed unit. It doesn't require a special flue. It burns corn. It burns feed corn. Dried feed corn, which is abundantly available in this country, and it burns with zero emissions and is exempt from no-burn EPA days and is exempt from EPA standards for the stoves.
Yeah, I think there are some people, though, who if there's anything with any combustible fuel in the house, they're going to get a problem. So people need to sort of be near the stove and see whether it affects them.
These are sealed units, so that they're sealed. Outdoor air comes in for the combustion, and there's no exchange of air with the breathable air inside.
My own experience when I lived in Berkeley was I used a DeLonghi heater, which is the one that has the oil inside the thing, and I found it very cost-effective to run if you're not living in a freezing cold place and you just heat the room near your body. Let's take another caller. You're on KPFA. You have a question?
Yes, you may have touched on this already. I missed part of the broadcast.
Shame on you.
About the Brita water filter, how effective is it? What does it?
The Brita remove? Water filter.
What does it not remove?
The Brita water filter, I don't think it's that effective just because there's not a lot of filtration capacity in it. Most of the filters that I'm more aware of that I think are better have at least a sizable amount of carbon block to them. I'm not really recommending the Brita.
Yeah, I haven't heard anybody recommend the Brita, actually. Let's move on, get some more of these wonderful callers on the air. It's 510-848-4425. We are having a show about creating a non-toxic home and office with David Kibbe and David Bierman, and we're taking your calls. Let's move on to another caller. You're on KPFA. Do you have a question?
Hi, yes. I was very interested in what was said about the masonry heaters.
Uh-huh.
I didn't hear it all. Could you please repeat what they are and who might deal in them?
Sure. The masonry heaters are an ancient European technique for creating a gentle radiant heat with a very clean burning, very hot flame, which is recirculated through the specially designed handcrafted stove in such a way as to heat actually the building materials of the building in a radiant heat system, which is actually more gentle and more favorable to the human body than even things like radiant floor heat and radiant baseboard heat. There is a company called European Masonry Heater Company in Napa, California. And if one were to call me at my number, 841-1039, I'd be happy to give you the number of Jim Donaldson, who runs that company.
Great. Thanks. Let's get some more of these callers on. You're on KPFA. Hello.
Is that me?
Yeah, it's you.
Hi. I was calling with some information, I believe, about the incredible insecticide chalk.
Aw.
I've been using it for years. It's available in every market that you go to in Mexico. I have a friend who's in the pesticide business who said that he believes its active ingredient is borax.
Oh, okay.
And, in fact, it is now not available in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. I've been trying for the last 5 or 6 months to find it, and it's been pulled from all the stores because I think the FDA got wind. Something that was being used widely by non-Asians. They don't seem to care when it's Asians or Hispanics or blacks, but when it gets out into the rest of the population, why then all of a sudden they take a look at it. And I don't know. I've never had any ill effects of it. I don't know what long-term effects of exposure to minute exposure to borax might be. But it is an incredibly effective thing for ants especially, but also for cockroaches.
You might want to call the FDA and ask them why did they pull it, because they would put them on the spot here, because they've been pulling lots of Chinese herbs and from the shelves for for no reason at all, and it'd be good to deal with that with regards to this particular item if it's so effective, and just give them a call and just rattle their cage a little bit.
Can't you just buy borax washing soda?
You can just buy borax. There are some people with high degrees of sensitivity who can react even to borax, which is otherwise considered essentially non-toxic. There is a very quick story, if I could tell, about natural insecticides, which it goes along with that. Borax, of course, is once again a way of killing the insects. There is an even kinder way to do it, which is to bait the insects and encourage them to go elsewhere than in your house. And I know there's a wonderful story about a Zen monk who put honey in the middle of the building and brought all the ants to a container in the middle of the building and then took it kindly out to the woods where they lived happily ever after.
With their honey.
So we could try something like
that. Yeah, we could do that. Another little warning about borax. I discovered when I went to, because it's a good alternative to bleach, if you want to stay away from chlorine, it helps whiten your clothing. I discovered that some stores put the borax next to the dryer sheets, and the borax is absorbent like baking soda. So when you get it home, it's full of the smell from the dryer sheets. So if you buy borax, make sure it's in a place in a store that's very far away from anything fragranced if you're sensitive. Let's get some more callers on. Caller, you're on KPFA. What have you got for us?
Hello. Yeah, I had a question about bedding, mattresses.
Good question.
In terms of conventional bedding, I've heard that it has formaldehyde.
You bet.
And what's really the safest kind of bedding that you would recommend? There's foam mattresses, there's futon with cottons, and I'm not really sure, you know, because the cottons have pesticides in them.
Yeah, well, let's try to respond to you, but we're going to have to take you off the air because you're buzzing at us. So thanks for your call.
All right.
I went on one of these journeys, but you want to go ahead?
Sure. I know David and I have both been through sagas of bedding experiments, and
terrifying.
We've tried virtually everything. It is true, as the caller said, that cotton is probably the most heavily pesticided industry we have. There are a number of people who are supplying cotton futon bedding, which is organically grown cotton, so that it is free of pesticides. One of the problems with cotton bedding is that it requires, according to FDA standards, that fireproofing be added to it. So you'll need a doctor's prescription to get it without fireproofing. And one would hope that also you're not a smoker. Wool is a great alternative to that, or sometimes a combination of cotton as the foundation futon and then wool as the springier, more resilient top futon makes a good kind of bedding if, in fact, you're not allergic to wool.
And there are companies that make organic cotton box springs and mattresses, which I actually own, and my colleague here also owns one as well. The little bit of concern with that is the bed springs themselves have magnetic fields, and they're in Europe. They're concerned about the issue of the springs, the static magnetic fields from the springs. So actually what I'm thinking of going back to is the non-toxic organic cotton wool combination futon, which I had a while back. So I'm actually going to move back to that myself.
I actually got lucky. My mattress that I was trying to replace, I discovered had a 15-year, huge warranty on it, and I called the company and I told them what my situation was. So they said if I brought the mattress in, spring mattress, that they would customize it for me. I begged, basically. And I went in and I said, no foam, no then, and that, and they did it, and it was okay. Mm-hmm.
So there are companies that will do that.
If you beg. Let's move on to some more callers very quickly. You're on KPFA with Lena Berman. What have you got? You got a little question for us? Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'm back to the Brita filters quickly here.
Uh-oh.
I've been recommending them and using them for a long time simply because they make the water taste better and smell better, and then we drink more water that way. So do you have a simple, effective alternative then if you don't like them?
This is David Kibbe speaking, and I would suggest that each of us has different criteria, each of us has different needs, and we each, I think, seek qualities in drinking water which are different, just as water itself differs from source to source. And I would say that if you feel that this filter makes the water taste better to you and you're able to drink more water, then I think that is a great idea and that you should do it. I don't think that it is wise to advise the use of one filter over another exclusively, because there are no such panaceas. I know that the very best water one could possibly drink would be naturally aged, mature water, which comes from a spring of its own volition rather than being drilled in a well. That would be the ideal water if it comes from a pure aquifer.
another important element is most people do have water filters, and there are ways now to check the water filter if it's filled up. Basically, is it leaking chlorine? There are actually little devices, little chemical tests you can buy to put into the water to see if it changes color, which means that the chlorine's getting through and the filter's bad. So a lot of people forget to change their water filters.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to some more callers. You're on KPFA, listener. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. This may be a subject for another time, but my problem is with fluorescent lights. Could you help me with fluorescent lights where I can't quit my job and all of that?
Okay, we'll give it a try. Thank you.
Thanks.
Fluorescent lights have the not just annoying but possibly psychologically damaging attribute of flickering. That's the way they operate. You'll find that the electromagnetic fields are less and the flickering is less if the fluorescent fixtures that are installed are electronic fluorescents rather than standard fluorescents. That might be one thing to look for. The other thing is to stay as distant as possible from the fluorescent light and to modify it with incandescent or natural daylight. If you can open the windows wider, move back the blinds, add skylights, put in reflective surfaces, anything at all to get daylight instead of fluorescent light, then you will certainly improve your physical surroundings.
And add an incandescent light near you.
And also you can, if it's possible, you should go to full spectrum fluorescent lights.
Which you can buy now. Let's move on to one or two more callers. You're on the air with KPFA. Do you have a question?
Yeah. I was wondering about two different things. One is we have a spring that has a holding tank, and I wondered if what type of filter would be an appropriate filter if we even would want to use one.
Okay, and then why don't you give us the second part real quick.
The second part with fleas. I've heard diatomaceous earth, borax. I'm wondering what would be a good way that I've tried just about everything.
Okay, we're going to take your call off the air.
Thank you.
With regards to the water filter, I would recommend they do have what's called hold house filters, which are reverse osmosis and carbon block. I would at least have a carbon block filter for that type of situation. You can go to a combination of reverse osmosis and carbon block if you're concerned about bacteria in the holding tank, or whatever types of materials are coming up out of the spring. Maybe heavy. Sometimes a lot of springs are pretty hard water, and they might have iron in them. So the reverse osmosis would take the iron out, and the carbon block would work very well in keeping the bacterial levels down.
Do we have a flea solution for this woman?
I believe so. You may be talking to the world's foremost experts on this because David and I both have crawled in crawl spaces where we have picked up fleas from other people's homes and brought them to our own, and each of us is unable to use pesticides in the normal way. I would say the number one absolute most important system for getting rid of fleas and flea eggs and larvae is the vacuum cleaner. And it may be tedious, but if you can vacuum clean the area that has been infested twice or three times a day for the first few days, and then at least once a day for the next several weeks, then you will undoubtedly remove all of the fleas. Diatomaceous earth also works. I know one of the things that we've done is to put a little bit of diatomaceous earth on the rug, on a rug or an area rug, and then vacuum a little bit up into the vacuum cleaner so that it kills the fleas that are in there. But at the very least, you must cover that vacuum cleaner with a garbage bag or dispose of the vacuum cleaner bag when you're done. Otherwise, the fleas crawl out the tube and get back into your house.
Another point with regards to vacuum cleaners is it's very important to get a vacuum cleaner with a high filtration bag.
Yes.
You tend to blow the dust back through the house if it's not a high filtration bag or a specifically designed one like a Miele or a Nilfest.
You know, I really want to thank all of you who participated in the show, and the two of you, David Kibbe and David Bierman. This was a great show, so thank you so much for coming in and doing it with me.
You're welcome.
I want to thank you all for listening. The engineers for Your Own Health and Fitness are Jade Alburo and Kevin Cartwright. If you have questions about what you heard on the show today or about exercise and diet, you can call me, Lena Berman, at my office during the week at 707-769-1458. Again, 707-769-1458. If you're interested in getting a taped copy of this show or any of our past shows, you can send a check for $10, which includes postage and handling. Indicate which show you'd like by subject, and include your mailing address to me, Lena, L-A-Y-N-A, Berman, B-E-R-M-A-N, P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. 2714 is the P.O. Box, 94953, Petaluma. You can also contact me to find out what other show subjects are available on tape. Next week at noon on Tuesday, I'll be back with a show called Women in Transformation, Examining the Hurdles. I'll be talking with psychologist Michelle Minero and taking your questions on the air. Tomorrow on Brainstorm Theater of the Imagination with Dr. Clarissa Pincoles Estes. Don't miss it. I'm Lena Berman. This has been your own health and fitness talk show on KPFA 94.1 FM.